All right, thanks, Bill. Our next speaker is going to be Toby Fitzsimmons from the University of Arkansas, speaking about the influence of temperature on diurnal carbohydrate assimilation.
Good morning, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here, speaking about the influence of temperature on diurnal carbohydrate assimilation. One of the things we need to just keep in mind is that carbohydrate assimilation only really occurs throughout every part of the plant's throughout every part of the plant. So I want to really take a look at heat. Heat is one of my areas that I actually absolutely love. And carbohydrates kind of have a unique relationship when it comes to that heat. In particular, carbohydrates are present in every detail of the plant. There is no part of the plant where carbohydrates cannot be found. You have cellulose of the fiber, lignin and the xylem trachids. You have energy sources for the plant, such as glucose, fructose, maltose. But the ones I really want to focus on today are the sucrose and the starch. And so the high temperatures in that cause a series of reactions that affects the entire organism. In particular, what we're looking at is energy imbalances. Also, increased membrane permeabilities, increased reactive oxygen species, things that cause increased antioxidant production. So the thing that most people see, though, is they see increased shedding and stunted growth of their plants. So we really want to take a look at and see, well, how does the carbohydrate affects across the entire board when you look at heat as well as day and night cycles? Because a plant doesn't just stop whenever the sun goes down. So some questions to kind of take a look at when you're looking at this. First, what effect does heat impart on the plant's ability to produce carbohydrate when examined diurnally? Also, what is occurring both internally as well as externally? What can we be able to do? Well, how can we bridge the gap of knowledge? So when we investigate that, we need to look at some temperatures to worry about. And there seems to be a key temperature point. And that key temperature point is about 32 degrees centigrade. Right at about that temperature, we're looking at our photosynthetic maximum efficiency. And right at about then, we begin a slow decline as the temperatures increase. Well, when you have a reduced photosynthetic efficiency, you're not going to be creating as much starch. That right there is the commonly held belief. Well, in the Mississippi Delta region, this slide here is from Marianna, Arkansas. That red line across the top indicates temperatures of 32 degrees centigrade. Any point above that is where majority of our flowering takes place. So for the most of the plant's reproductive development, whenever we're seeing high temperature stress, at least on the photosynthetic capacity of the plant. So as we move in, we want to look at some developmental periods. And what I did here is I went across the state of Arkansas here, and I grabbed 10 weather stations, data from northern Arkansas all the way down to the southern part, and I averaged all their data together. And I took a look and I said, okay, well, we have what's the average high temperature of Arkansas at this time? Well, we also have what's the average low temperature during this time as well. And I also went onto the USDA website, and they have a fantastic tools, and I analyzed their survey data, and I investigated what percentage of fields surveyed actually had an amount of squaring as well as an amount of flowering that was occurring. Then I ran the numbers, and I saw that temperatures that were above 32 degrees, you're seeing that's at that point, squaring is actually already basically occurred. Flowering is just beginning. So to even take a step further, I went, okay, well, let's look at Marianna, Arkansas. Marianna, Arkansas is positioned right at about centrally in the Mississippi Delta region. So it's a really good proxy. So on the average planting date, I took from 1990 all the way to 2010, just averaging them all together, and about May 15th is what we're looking at for planting date. And since squaring typically bends about 40 days after that, we said June 21st. Kind of approximates within this line right here. So we have not yet hit 32 degrees centigrade on average whenever this happens. Now, that's not to say that from a year-to-year variability what's going to happen. But you flip a coin 100 times, you expect it to land 50 times on tails. In this case, flowering occurs right about 50% of the time whenever it's surveyed, right in the middle of the high temperature stress. This is to emphasize that flowering for cotton in this Mississippi Delta region is whenever we're experiencing that photosynthetic efficiency problems. So let's move into the circadian rhythm aspects. The circadian rhythm is a day and night cycle. We have it when we get tired. Plants also have it. The thing is, though, is that carbon exchange rates actually typically peak at about noon, and then they slowly decrease over the course of the afternoon, and then immediately drop all the way down at night. However, carbon exchange rates actually remain about pretty much at a flat line. And we suspect this is more from the Hendricks and Huber 1986. They suspect that this is more due to the respiration. It remains pretty much constant throughout. We also have the sucrose export. Cotton is a natural exporter of sucrose. If it makes enough, it will export it. There's no questions, day or night. So during the day, whenever we're building up all this extra sucrose, we're exporting it. However, at night, we're also exporting it. We see a decrease right there at dusk, but then we see a rise. And that rise is because the starch is being converted. So that starch is being converted and then exported. So we have to have maximal photosynthetic efficiency to be able to produce enough starch to be able to produce the sucrose at night that we can export, so we can maintain a constant stream throughout the flower. So let's take a look at the basic circadian rhythm just to kind of summarize what we're looking for. At night, we have starch and an ATP depletion. During the day, we have a starch and ATP production. And at both times together, we see an export of sucrose to the tissues. Now, some things to keep, things to understand is that only about 5% of the starch actually remains within the leaf by dawn. So we have actually converted all of our reserves by this point. And also, our ATP and ADP ratios are actually very low. So we've used up most of our energy resources. So, but at dawn, you'd expect ATP levels would increase, photosynthesis also increases, and again, the starch production ramps up, basic circadian rhythm. And so because of that, the cotton, it facilitates its high level of starch storage, and it is, it's a high starch storing organism, and that's why it's able to transport that sucrose throughout all hours. But temperature does have an effect. What about at night? Well, that's kind of a good segue. What about at night? Well, we have hexose concentrations, right? So we have the glucose and fructose. We have those concentrations. They actually decrease whenever you increase the temperature. And we're not talking about substantially high temperature increase. We're only talking just by a couple of degrees centigrade. Well, whenever you have that over a long period of time, you're going to see your pools decrease. Respiration rates are also going to substantially increase. When you have those respiration rates increase, then more energy has to be shuttled, that the sucrose, instead of actually going out and being exported to, say, bowls and flower development, you're now going into more of a respiration survival mode. And ATP concentrations, these also decrease at night. So you take a look at high temperature stress. It doesn't take a lot of high temperature at night. People typically think, oh, it's nice and cool. However, whenever you have, at night, humidities also increase. You also have some problems with vapor pressure differentials. The plant is constantly trying to move things. It's not able to photosynthesize any more starch, so it's breaking it all down. And so if you have a breakdown of increased temperature, then it's going to utilize more. Seems fairly simple at this point. Oops, where's it going? Ah, there we go. So let's take a look during the day. So we're talking about starch and ATP production at this point. Well, let's take a look at Rubisco. Rubisco seems to be one of the primary points of chinks in that armor. Rubisco itself, now theoretically, as those squares indicate, should continuously increase. That's what the theory says. However, in reality, what we see is a defining decrease. Once temperatures hit about that magic number, about 32 degrees centigrade, everything begins to drop off. But I want to take that subset that's in there, and I want to really kind of expand that and show that there is a linear increase in respiration. So even with temperature, it doesn't even have to be a large increase in temperature, your respiration rates are going to increase. That means that you're going to have More of that carbon going to be transferred into the hexoses to be used for the immediate cell needs rather than exported into starch. But there's some other things here to also consider. And that is, we also have genetic differences as well. So not necessarily does 32 degrees is a concrete, hard, fast rule for everything. And some species, and some cultivars and varieties, we actually have 32 degrees may not be the worst. In this particular one, VH260, we have the maximum at 40 degrees centigrade. We're actually pretty close to it. So there are some characteristics we need to investigate with the genetics aspect. Let's continue on with the starch and ATP. So let's think about that high temperature now. So we're still there. Turns out that Rubisco may also have a friend, and that is the Rubisco activase. And that Rubisco activase is what allows Rubisco to open up those 8 activation sites on its molecule and be able to and actually work as a carboxylate. However, under heat stress, the activase presses. It's not as efficient. And at 35 degrees centigrade, we're talking about a photosynthetic loss potential of about 16%, which is quite substantial. So whenever you reduce the levels of Rubisco activation under heat stress, we can see it, is that the ribulase 1,5-phosphate, the precursor, rises and the 3-PGA decreases. So we know Rubisco is not being activated. Because it's not being activated in those high temperatures, we're not able to produce, continue on the cycle. So let's also continue in the day. So not only do we have heat stress that's also increasing the reactive oxygen species. So we have heat, we're causing more stress on the plant. What we're also doing is we're also decreasing whatever's there for the ATP. So we're also dropping those down. So not only are we having more reactive oxygen species, we're also having a decrease in the ATP throughout the day. And all that turn, within you look inside the pistol, there's also a reduced amount of ATP, a reduced amount of energy inside that pistol to be used to help for reproductive success. So let's take a look at the export. So we have the exporter that's sucrose to the tissues. And we have, for like Ashe in 1972, I indicated about 60% of the fixed carbon for the bulk comes from the subtending leaf. So that seems to be the primary sink right there for the subtending leaf. However, if you think about the whole plant on its level, you do show that depending upon where in that canopy is where the translocation is going to occur. About node 12, that's whenever you see the leaves actually become true exporters. Below that, you're actually talking about importers. And we can see that just because of shading effects. Your photosynthetic efficiency is going to go down, so the plants that are actually receiving more light, they're going to transport more. And whenever we get down to about node 8, we're actually seeing levels that are far, far low, and so we're actually having to really draw in from other sources. So let's take a look on the flower just a little bit closer. Now this is three points. We have the before flowering, and then we also have the at flowering, and we have the day after flowering. On the left, we have the ovary at a normal, approximately a nice control temperature, about 32 degrees. And on the right, we have an ovary at about 40 degrees centigrade. So very warm stress. What we see is that things are fairly constant between the carbohydrates the day before and the day of flowering. It's the day after flowering when things start to change. And that is the carbohydrate load across almost every part, and particularly with the sucrose concentrations, do those drop. Less carbohydrates, reduced reproductive efficiency. Excuse me. And this, in turn, also has led to increased abscission rates. So when we actually look at an overall picture, you combine everything into the soluble carbohydrate of the pistil. Other researchers have found that that's exactly the same thing that happens. Whenever you increase that temperature, the carbohydrate load decreases. So with increased temperatures, we're experiencing less of an effect. And that's even at moderate temperatures. Those weren't extreme like 40 degrees centigrade. So let's take a step back and think, okay, well, when about flowering is the most sensitive? And so when you start looking at it, well, the first 14 days is really when it's most sensitive. So you have those 14 days, and a lot can change. A lot can happen. That's 2 weeks worth. Temperature, water, and carbohydrate load. And again, carbohydrate load seems to play an enormous factor on the abscission rates. So we can take a look at the high temperature effects on the bull whenever it's done, and we're seeing the high temperature will shift the carbohydrate balance towards bulls that seem to be more productive versus others that increase the fruit shed. So that seems typical. We've all seen this in the field. But whenever you start looking at the fiber itself, we're actually looking at the micronair in this case. And that is, when we start looking at that, the warm temperatures will actually help facilitate the push of sucrose into the carbohydrate, of the flow into the bowl, which in turn will actually cause a thickening of that fiber. And if you have a thickening of that fiber, it's more coarse. If you get too coarse, it's not exactly the effect that you want for your prices. So if we have an increased amount of flow, yes, a little bit of warm temperatures are nice, but too much, not enough. But sucrose also does an amazing other thing, and that it also helps. It also works as a. I know I have it written here as hormonal, but I won't go that far. But I will say it also works as a regulatory function. And in this picture right here, what I have is I have famine genes. And whenever sucrose is actually at a high, low, it'll initiate these genes to start activating. So increased photosynthesis, increased remobilization, increased export. Whenever we have a feast, that means we have a lot of stuff going, we have a lot of sucrose around. Well, then things begin to be inhibited. So we have photosynthesis. Sucrose may work as a competitive inhibitor on Rubisco. Temporarily, we might see phosphorus efficiency. We also could see a export. We also see some utilization aspects. Again, with the competitive inhibition, some of the research that I've seen has shown that sucrose itself can actually block some of those activation sites, slowing down Rubisco's ability to create 3-PGA. But also the neat thing is that sucrose can also, in turn, modulate starch synthesis. And that's through the trehalose-6-phosphate pathway. And that is a really unique thing. If you have a lot of sucrose, that trehalose says, hey, we need to get started, and then it kicks in. But sucrose can also initiate the secondary metabolites, such as anthocyanin. So there's also some work to be done about, particular with flowers and whatnot, and the carbohydrates and the sucroses, and how those may affect the coloring schemes. And one of the primary ways it does this is through basically the BZIF11 transcription factor. One of the things that in the research that I've found here is that this translation and inhibition of it, so it's not affecting it genetically, it's affecting it more on the mRNA aspects, but it actually has a profound effect on how plant growth and plant regulation occurs. So just some final thoughts in terms of is that heat impacts cotton very negatively at even relatively warm temperatures. We wouldn't exactly think 32 degrees as being excessively hot. But to the cotton plant, it is. So we see those photosynthetic decreases. We see an increased respiration rates. We also see, and in turn, decreased energy pools that the plant has to be able to try to reshuffle and mobilize for the remainder of the day and night. But heat stress can also impair the ability to plant and make and transport carbohydrates. So again, it goes into survival mode rather than reproductive mode. And throughout all this reading of this literature, see, the circadian rhythm is actually sensitive at almost any stage. And the primary thing that I have found is that night temperatures seem to be one of the most understudied concepts. We spend a lot of time looking at high day temperatures, but night temperatures seem to also be increasing as well. And I don't feel like we're taking enough of a step to investigate even a 1 or 2 degree change as opposed to 1 or 2 degree change during the day. Just a quick point just for references and whatnot, there's a lot of people that I went through to be able to analyze some of the stuff, and some of them are actually here today, and nice to see them. But I do have a couple seconds, so if you guys have any questions, I'd be more than happy to take them. Yes, sir.
Yeah, a lot of folks will have put a maximum on the 80-60 cap Hmm?
Absolutely. If we're talking about having for a D60, if we're talking about a maximum model for the day, and we're also showing that we're seeing effects at night, it makes sense that you'd want to also impose a maximum at night. So when does that occur? Are we talking about respiration effects? Are we talking about sucrose export rates? We need to kind of look in that model. But yeah, I totally agree. I think we should really kind of investigate and look into that. Yes, sir.
While you can see these temperatures above 32 degrees, and they may, as you suggested in a slide, reduce photosynthesis 16 to 25%, often it's only doing that for a period of maybe an hour out of the photosynthetic assimilation period, which may be 6 or 7 or 8 hours long. So while it looks like a large number, it may be a very transient effect that for that hour really matters.
Mm-hmm.
But in the total of the entire day, that effect just sort of disappears.
And you know what? You actually have a very good point. You know, whenever we measure a max temperature, we're only measuring it at the maximum time. We're not measuring, you know, on the slope. And that's why I think that it's probably really good to think about the microclimate aspects as well. So we not only do have the upper canopy, and if you look at the research, a lot of people are doing the max temperature. But I agree wholeheartedly with you. We need to look at the leaf temperature. We need to look at the IR temperatures of the upper canopy, the lower canopy. We need to investigate the shading effects. And yes, I know that we're looking at a transient possibility, but if you deplete that pool consecutively over a long period of time, what minor effects would you have? And so that's something to it's also something to keep in mind. If I break a leg, it's only a little transient time in my life, but it hurts really bad for that moment. So just to kind of keep it going. So that's what kind of thing we need to keep in mind. Anything else?
We've got
Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks.